me.
Ahoy there, I'm up above you. I'm in this hang glider. Look, here I am.
Oh, look at you. Oh, good God, you're not wearing any trousers.
No, don't worry about that. Circling round like an albatross on the breeze. Look, here I come.
With
no trousers on. Yes, here I go. Yeah. Oh, and down onto the deck.
A courgette.
Just concentrate on the grace, yes. The beauty, the agility. Oh. There we go.
See that. You did that very nicely.
Yes, I'm just going to.
What do you do? Do you fold that away, or do you just?
I'm just going to pop it here on the deck. It just folds down pretty small. If I wanted to take it with me, you know, in a travel suitcase, I could. But I'm just going to leave it there, unfolded.
Very clever.
For now.
Very clever.
And how are you?
Considering it's imaginary, yes. Well, I'm very well. It's very, very nice to. I was going to say see you, but I'm seeing you in my mind.
We can't see each other, can we? See each other. We're not allowed to see each other.
Simply not allowed.
Before we were just simply in different places, but we could, in principle, have seen one another.
Yes.
But now I think it's probably illegal for us to see one another. Is that right? I'm not quite up on the new regulations, but I don't know.
I don't know. Well, we can see each other through the Zoom, I suppose, couldn't we? Through the good offices of Zoom.
Oh, Martin, I tell you, I've had a few Zoom calls this week. Oh, I tell you, it's been very tricky.
What's the latest? What's the latest over there in Belgium?
Oh, I have had an absolutely horrendous week. As you know, I turned up for my initial, my initial... meeting with the team to sort of, can't tell you what the name of the sandwich company is, but it's a very, very important sandwich company, yes. Global in reach. And anyway, I went there to sort of glad hand a few employees, you know, do my bit, you know, take a photo of me in a paper hat, you know, backstage somewhere, you know, would have gone in all the trades. But anyway, look, unfortunately... Yes.
Paper hat. I see what you mean. A chef's paper hat.
A chef's paper hat, yes.
So I thought, I was thinking for you were going in for a sort of lunch or something where you're all just ball crackers.
No, there wasn't a part. No,
not a paper crown.
A hygienic hat.
I was picturing a crown. I'm putting all crown thoughts to the back of my mind.
That's what it was, a crown in a sense, because I am something of a celebrity, as you know, in the business.
In the sandwich.
Oh, anyway, then I was confined to barracks because it turned out that... you know, my sub-assistant manager here basically had tested positive, so blah, blah, blah. So anyway, I've been in the flat all week. I have had a horrendous, horrendous week. Not in terms of very used to being, to staying within four walls. I'm very used to that. Just creatively, Martin, I've had a terrible time. I've had a complete block. I've got a creative block. There's a new sandwich on the menu. I'm not going to go into too many details or you'll guess the name of the sandwich chain, but... I'm just going to say it involves it's just a very straightforward brioche bun, and there's pastrami, and then there's a bit of pickle, and maybe a bit of sauerkraut. And I have got to come up with a killer description for this sandwich. And I have just been about my wit's end. I don't know what's happened to me, but every ounce, every featherweight of creativity seems to have deserted me this week. No, I don't know what it... I mean, is it... I mean, in some sense, it's a bit like a Reuben, but, you know, a Reuben would have mustard. You know, Reuben often has cheese. There's no cheese in this sandwich. I've just absolutely... I'm at my bloody wit's end, I tell you.
Okay, just let me conjure up a picture for her of it on my mind, see if I can be of any use to her. You know, sometimes the brioche buns are there, they look almost like they've been boiled in a sort of, before they were then baked.
They have a glaze.
So it's a kind of dark glaze. Does it have poppy seeds on top? Oh, good. Does it have sesame seeds on the top there? Maybe the blackened sesame seeds.
I think there might be a smattering of sesame seeds on there, yeah.
And is it a molded top to the?
Yes, it's got like two little humps.
Yes. I can see it. But probably looked a little bit like the paper hat you were wearing.
Not unlike the paper hat, the hygienic paper hat. Yes.
Yes. Okay.
Are you going to ask me other questions, or is that it?
No. Well, I don't want to pry. Don't pry, Craig.
Well, there's three. If you must know, there's three slices of pastrami in there.
Three, okay, but they're very, 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 very thin.
Very thin.
Yes.
There's no cheese. Hence, I have real trouble comparing this to a Reuben. Like I say, the only touchstone I have is a Reuben.
I've never heard of a Reuben. I'll be quite frank with you.
Well, a Reuben is Reuben is a very odd sandwich all on its own. A Reuben is a sort of New York Jewish deli sandwich. But I don't understand it. But it's not actually a kosher sandwich, as it mixes meat with dairy. I don't know why it's called a Reuben. I mean, I really... This is all such a confusing area I found myself in, Martin. I really don't know where to turn.
Goodness, yes. I can see. I'm guessing Reuben was probably the owner of the cafe or the sandwich outlet that dispatched these things to a hungry populace.
Yes, yes, probably.
So therefore it's called a Reuben. Rather like the Harry's Bar, I don't know.
Yeah, cocktail. Or the Peach Melba.
Yes. The Peach Melba, named after the Melba.
Yeah, yeah.
And her peach.
I'm struggling now to think of any foods that are named.
Yeah, I can't think of anything, but I'm sure there are plenty of things. Yeah, there's probably a Daniel sandwich or a
biscuit Schofield.
Betty's tea room. I mean, that's actually named after. It is actually called Betty's tea. It's a bad example. Anyway, let's plough on. So, have you? Why don't you? Here's a thought. Why don't you maybe?
If you can just go for a walk, Martin, that's very cruel indeed.
That is cruel, isn't it?
I can't.
In the absence of that, what about something mind-altering? Not necessarily a bottle of brandy from downstairs, but maybe...
One of those strong Belgian beers. Maybe something
A blonde beer from Belgium.
Oh, yeah. Or just something psychedelic. You know, like go for some friture and mussels and ask them to just slip in a dodgy mussel. Something like that, just to sort of take me to Lewis Carroll territory. Yes, okay.
Take you elsewhere. Yes, get high on a dodgy cephalopod.
Speaking of dodgy cephalopods.
Oh yes, go on.
No one has ever used that ever as a segue.
Speaking, yes.
What's been happening at Dunmore?
Oh, you know, the same old thing, really. Nothing of great importance has really taken place at Dunmore. Is still working hard over in his forge, which is very exciting, and the smithy.
What's happening in the fields? I mean, what does happen in the fields at this time of year? You've harvested your mange too.
We've harvested
the
mange
too. Do you have to plough something back in? Or
well,
you
see, normally
like
we would be ploughing, but I am now instigating a new policy of no plough.
Yes, of course.
Will not till. It's a no-till farm now. We are going to be building up our soil health. And what we have to do is, I've been reading a book, and what we have to do is bring in a great many head of cattle, a really ludicrous number of cattle, for a short period. They've got to come in and just do their thing, and then we move them on.
Oh, yeah.
And then, yes, this seems to be what you do. I suppose you're basically trying to replicate the action, the movements of the bison on the great Central American plain.
Oh, how wonderful.
That's
so they're
essentially
going
what
to,
you're doing, and it replenishes the soil, puts all the goodness back in. It's all very exciting anyway. But, yes, so I'm not doing any ploughing.
They're going to shit all over the field, and then you're going to... What?
Then, I mean, we'll obviously plant the next... We'd plant it, but they grow very quickly, the mange tour. You know, the stocks go in... You know, the rootstocks go in after sort of March, I think. You know, so
basically, you just do nothing from September to March. Would that be?
That's kind of right. I mean, a little bit of forestry.
What do you specifically do in forestry?
Well, we've felled quite a number of trees. Last year and the year before, and we are now replanting. We are putting new broadleaf trees in to replace them. But yes, I mean, you know, it's a matter of draining the soil. I haven't thought about this. Maybe I shouldn't be draining the soil with the new no-till policy. Anyway, there's a thing
well,
to chew
both
on.
We're both at a crossroads, aren't we? Both at a sort of creative crossroads.
Aren't we, though?
With our projects.
Oh. I wonder if the hat could come into the name of the thing. I wonder if you could call it the brown hat or the
I maybe, think the brown hat would be a tricky name for a sandwich. I think
it sounds like some
I'm just
terrible...
popping off for a brown hat sounds like you're basically going to do what the bison do on was it the Midwestern Plain? What did you call it?
Central American plain.
Yes, or being a brown hatter, I think.
I think we've gone. It opens up so many possibilities, the brown hat, and I'm not sure any of them's particularly pleasant. Where are we in the cultural, in the geist? Well, what's going on in the time ghost?
Where we are in the time ghost, Martin. We're a little bit late to the party. Just imagine the graphic just swirling in. Whoa,
to the party.
Watch out! That massive rock.
Whoa.
Late
to the...
Cracks appearing in the end. Collapsing onto the floor. Yes.
And then in comes a red-hot brand. It goes...
Party! We're late to the party. In graphics. Yes.
Yes.
Because...
Good heavens above.
I thought we would...
tell me.
Schitt's Creek swept the nominations the awards.
Yes.
I don't know if you remember that. So
absolutely, it did, yeah.
I mean, not that reason. I mean, we're late to the party even in doing this item, typically.
Oh, the party's all but gone.
I mean, the Emmys.
The only
how
thing
long
left
ago
of
was
the,
that?
The
Emmys was what? But anyway...
Only thing all that's left of the Emmys is the Portaloos. Still haven't taken them.
And they will never be able to take them.
Never.
Because
never
of,
will. Never will.
Yeah, they'll have to torch the insides of them. They'll have to sort of strafe them with naphthalene or something to be able to get the nasty little germs.
To be
able to get those off.
Be gone.
You know, the Ryan Gosling's shedded coronavirus.
The tiny sneezings of Ryan Gosling. Anyway, sorry, late to the...
Party! Essentially, I thought I would watch that, because I thought, well, it's won all these Emmys. I better catch up on Schitt's Creek. It's supposed to be pretty good. I have to say, I was always slightly put off by the title of the show.
Yes.
I think, you know, there is precedent for a show being funny when it's got a pun in its title, but they're few and far between.
Fawlty Towers is the only one I can think of. Springs to Mind. Well, no, we are both great minds.
Yes, the only
show. Boring Minds. I don't know. Take it.
Predictable Minds.
How did you find it, Craig? How far have you got into it?
I had an expression on my face during Schitt's Creek that's a bit like the one where you're waiting at the barrier at the arrivals section of the airport for a relative to arrive who you know fairly well, but not that well, and you would probably recognise them from a photo, but not necessarily in real life. They might have put on a bit of weight, might have lost a bit of weight, might be wearing a brown hat.
Yes.
But anyway, you have this expectant smile on your face, as if you're about to be rewarded with a crushing wave of emotion. And then you realise, actually, they've missed the flight. And you look at your text messages and think, oh, they're not arriving for another 17 hours. I've just got to go home and come back again. That was the expression on my face, precisely. Because I was hoping for something, for a familiar face to arrive in the form of something that seemed funny, but it didn't actually ever arrive. What experience did you have?
I'm very much the same. I saw the first episode, and only the first episode, and I was willing it to be lovely because I like the idea of it. I like the idea, Craig. I think, you know, somebody who, you know, a family of the not just the wealthy, but the super wealthy. This is a sort of a new stratum of wealth, isn't it? The super wealthy of the West Coast. And
well, yes, perhaps we should explain, you know, just outline the premise, you know, for the listener.
Yes. So super rich, very, very, very rich, and slightly very spoilt children, rather indulged, super rich family, husband and wife. She very much likes her designer brands, doesn't she? And she wears lots of wigs. And,
she's an actress. She was an actress in a previous...
That's right, she was a soap star or something, wasn't she, I think?
That's right.
And they've been swindled out of their fortune. But they have to go and live in a town that they bought just for fun. You know, I was waiting, as you say, for the dear genial relation to come bundling through with her trolley. But no arrival.
Is it fair to say it just feels a bit bad taste? It just seems to be, as one friend of mine put it, a lot of rich people making jokes about poor people.
But I think just given the extraordinary response there's been to it, it must improve. It must improve. Must get better.
I wonder if it's just a victim of its premise. It's like one of the things that I found was sort of made me resistant to it was such a big premise. You know, it was a very much a kind of, I thought, oh, I know how this has happened. You know, Eugene Levy has gone into a room with Dan Levy and they've pitched this sort of, it's like a one-line idea, isn't it? It's like, you know, this rich family go and have to go and live with poor people. It's like the Beverly Hillbillies in reverse. Then the exec leans forward and he says, but who's going to play the guy? I am. Oh, what? You're kidding me. I mean, who else can be in it? Catherine O'Hara. She's amazing. She's been in all the, you know, movies I've done with Chris Guest. Okay, yeah, yes. Great, let's go.
You do Second City with me.
Yes, exactly. So, okay. I mean, it feels like it was a pitch that should never have been a show. And I wonder if what happens is, and I'm never going to watch it, so I'm never going to find out, but my guess would be it outlives its premise and they have to give the characters a little bit more to do. They have to round them out more and it ends up being more of a sort of feel-good kind of show. You know, I mean, something like that has to happen further down the line.
Surely they have to learn how to rub along and how to get on with everybody and have to, you know, they have to have their corners knocked off on. That's essentially, that is one of the rules. This is a fable, isn't it, really?
Yeah, and I think, I guess by the second series, they're not, you know, we hate them in the first series because they're sort of gazillionaires. Yes. And they seem very overprivileged and, you know, they seem to lack any... basically sociopathic at the beginning. Funny as they are essentially sociopathic. And I guess, you know, by the second series, they're not really, you know, the height of the dive is not so great, is it? Presumably they're a little bit more, they're just a bit up themselves, but they're not grossly overprivileged. I suppose another sort of interesting thing about Schitt's Creek is the blatant nepotism. I mean, you could call it sort of touching, you know, maybe, you know, talent runs in families. There's different ways to look at it, aren't there? Because, of course, apart from Dan Levy, who I think I'm correct, plays the son, right? And Eugene Levy plays the father. You've also got Sarah Levy, who plays the waitress. And I'm pretty sure there's another Levy in the producer credits. So, what's going on there, Martin?
Oh, that's interesting. I wonder if they've fallen into the same trap as Brendan O'Carroll. Did you read about this? Mrs. Brown's Boys.
No.
The comedy. The comedy, Mrs. Brown's Boys, which everyone's loved because it is very much a family, you know, the O'Carroll family
are
very much. Well, it is, yes. They're all very, very, they're all in it up to their armpits. Turns out, though, someone's discovered that all the O'Carrolls get paid about twice as much as everyone else on the payroll. Yeah, and someone said, "Hang on, how much do you get paid per episode?" Go, well, it's good. I don't. I just get. Sorry, I'm not going to do the accent because it'll be upsetting.
Oi, quickly, pop me with onion. Puppy first.
Oh,
tits.
I will do it then.
Look at me first tits. I'll probably get about the same as you do.
He has got a funny laugh, hasn't he? I can't remember. He's got a
hoik,
I can't remember how it goes.
Hoik, hoik.
Hoik, hoik, hoik. Ka-ching, ka-ching. Hoik, hoik. Every time he laughs, another golden sovereign falls.
I don't blame him, though. But come on, it's all Brendan O'Carroll. It's all him. The show is all him.
True.
I mean, the rest of them are, you know, I mean, to pay anyone else on the show, frankly, is generous, I think. I mean, he's quite clearly the only one with any talent. And he's got a lot of it. I mean, he's got a lot of it.
He has.
But
he's had a lot of time for Brendan.
Yeah, I think we see eye to eye on this, Martin. I know it's not trendy and it's not cool, but I think Mrs. Brown's Boys is really, really funny. I think it's very, very funny. And I think he's brilliant. I'm not so sure about the others. I think if that show was a bicycle, let's put it this way, it's some relation of the tandem.
Well, it's a penny farthing, surely. There's one massive wheel and a little caster next to it.
But it's just very common now, isn't it, is wanting to keep it in the family.
Yes.
I mean, another example, of course, would be Lee Child. We have to talk about this. We have to talk about this.
Oh, my goodness.
The Jack Reacher novels.
Jack Reacher.
So
isn't it
I'm just going to tell the listener that Lee Child, the writer of the Jack Reacher novels, is going to pass the franchise on to his brother.
I think you've got that absolutely spot on. You've got it spot on. It's exactly right. But they're going to write in tandem for the next three books. They're going to write them together.
Yeah.
And then Lee is going just to back away very gently. He's going to moonwalk like Michael Jackson out of the scene and leave his brother Andrew on stage With the his brother Andrew is, by the way, also a novelist. Also writes quite sort of muscly prose, I think. Hard man prose, I think it's sometimes described as a style.
Have you ever read any Jack Reacher novels?
Never in my life, no.
No, I haven't.
I tell you what, though, as a franchise, it is worth over $1 billion, probably, dollars, which is almost the same as £1 billion.
Well, yeah. Probably by the end of this conversation, it'll be the same as £1 billion, given the way
$1 billion. $1 billion.
$1 billion.
That
now
is
pounds.
The same as £1 billion and £2.
So, I mean, the thing, I've never read Jack Reacher either, but I do know a little bit about it in that I know that what Lee Child is very good at doing, and I know this because I read someone else talking about why they liked the Jack Reacher novels. I think it was Malcolm
more than I've done.
Gladwell. Malcolm Gladwell, writing in a literary magazine, said that what Lee Child does brilliantly and like no one else is, for example, if Jack Reacher's going to have a knife fight, he will take you through every quiver of psychology in the mind of Jack Reacher. In other words, what he really, really gets into is not the externals of the fight, but the internals. What he's thinking, what he's anticipating, how he thinks it's going to go. Whether he's basically all the tiny little micro judgments that lead Jack Reacher to success or failure in any given sequence in the book. So it sounds very, very. Here's my point, though. This sounds. I thought, oh wow, that sounds amazing. I now wish. Almost wish I'd read a Jack Reacher novel, but not quite enough to ever read one. But I did think, oh, that does sound impressive. What I also thought was, that sounds quite difficult. And if Malcolm Gladwell is saying that Lee Child is capable of doing something that he's not capable of, I wonder if Lee Child's brother is as capable. And you know, writing books, I'm not sure. It's being treated in this instance, isn't it? Is it like it's sort of... I mean, could anybody write a Jack Reacher novel? Is all we need for Lee Child to just put his wing over us for a couple of books and then we'd be okay?
We'd be okay. It may well be. Maybe he'll say, look, here's a couple of notes. Always in such an instance, this. Never follow this pattern, always follow this. Da-da-da-da-da, this goes like that. And by the way, Andrew, good luck. Because somebody, this is interesting, every 13 seconds, somebody buys a Jack Reacher book.
That's definitely not me.
Bono told me that in an advert.
Well, every 13 seconds, quite annoying. Bono buys a Jack Reacher novel. Just quickly before we finish, I'd just like to talk of late to the party as well.
Yeah,
I'm a little bit late to the party for Black History Month. I don't know if you saw. There's a fantastic documentary on at the moment called Enslaved.
Oh yes, Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah, it says it's called Enslaved with Samuel L. Jackson. It's not Enslaved with Samuel L. Jackson. Samuel L. Jackson is in it a blink of an eye would be generous. I don't know. He almost just sort of walks past the camera at one point in his trademark Kangol hat, and that's about it. So it's quite unusual. It's quite unusual as a documentary. I mean, it's sort of. I think what's shaping up is that each episode is going to be about a different slave ship. It's very, very interesting. It reminds you slightly of Who Do You Think You Are? Sometimes there's always a chat with a particularly sort of curly-haired historian who's wearing cotton gloves at some point.
Yes,
but really, it's a very tricky watch. I mean, the story is very, very moving. I mean, and particularly the first episode that I saw, you know, the stories of horrendous things that were done in the name of in the name of the slave trade, but. Is a very odd mix of presenters. It's a very, very peculiar thing when you see, for example, you know, Afua Hirsch is one of the presenters and she's brilliant in it. You know, she's mixed heritage. But you've got some, I don't know why they're there, some white presenters. This is the problem, is the inherent problems of the whole thing. They're still there in the programme itself. And I suppose that's what's so fascinating, because you often have this very awkward situation where, for example, at one stage, the white presenter and Samuel L. Jackson are looking at a portrait painting, and they're talking about a particular figure in the British judiciary who made one of the landmark decisions in the slave trade. And they're saying that the reason that he did that is that he had a black, he had adopted a black girl into his family, and that he therefore was sympathetic. And the white presenter immediately goes, you see, he was a kind of good guy. He was a kind of good guy. And Samuel L. Jackson immediately says, what, you're saying because he adopted a black girl, he was a good guy? It's fascinating. The whole programme is exquisitely awkward. Everyone awkward treading eggshells. On awkward,
nobody
awkward
wanting
eggshells.
To say anything that will upset or mansplain or whitesplain or blacksplain or whatever. Nobody wants to. Oh
yes, and as a result, and as a result of not wanting to have anyone be splained to. There are about 20 presenters of the programme. I mean, literally there are.
Oh, my God.
I mean, there's just... And a lot of it, I understand why it's done. And it is also the right thing to do. But it's a sort of... It encapsulates beautifully the mess we're in at the moment.
Yes.
The whole show.
Is Samuel L. Jackson...
Great. Well, he's great. I just wish he was in it more. I mean, he's literally only in about... He's only in it for about 20 seconds.
Well, that's
he's in it for long enough for them to be able to call it... Enslaved with Samuel L. Jackson. And I think full marks to anybody for giving it a go. It's a really important story that needs to be told. But the very show itself highlights really all the contradictions and difficulties that there are in talking about this whole area. Very interestingly, there's section on Edward Colston in the story. And I couldn't quite figure out whether they'd made this before they pulled the statue of Edward Colston down during the Bristol Black Lives Matter demonstration.
Yes.
And I don't know.
Well, I mean,
the Colston
conversation has been going on for 4 or 5 years. I mean, in Bristol, they'd been campaigning to change the name of the Colston Hall, for example, which they now have. It's now called the Bristol Beacon. The Bristol Beacon.
Yeah. And, yes,
it's very interesting.
And I don't know. Yes. I mean, I don't know. Will you be watching it, Martin? Do you think you'll give
I think
it a look?
I will, but I think, as you say, I mean, it will make me uncomfortable and it'll probably make me rather sad because I think... The difficulty here is everybody's reluctance to... Because they know that there is a shared story, but the two sides of that story are so immeasurably contrasting that there's no sense of sharing the same story. Mm. So no one can own the whole story. You can only own your half of it. One of those halves... is very virtuous, and the other half is very shameful.
Yes, and I suppose that's the thing about the documentary is it attempts to contrive a meeting point, and that is what is interesting about it because the meeting point is not there yet. I mean, I can't help it because here's the reaction you have if you're white and you watch the show. You think, oh, get these white people out of this show. Can't we have the black people finding out from the black people what happened? Why do we have to have the white people there explaining it to the black people? Literally. But then I suppose that awkwardness is also part of the story. And I think, as you say, that meeting point... You know, that meeting point is confected at the moment, and it feels confected in the show.
That's it.
Yes. Anyway, you can't get more late to the party than that. A documentary about the slave trade.
There you go. Yes.
But there is one last late to the party that. Emily in Paris. We mentioned it last week.
We did. Yes. But, don't tell me you've watched it.
I think this is the reason I've not been able to write my sandwich description this week. I think that's why I've had such a mental block is, I think Emily in Paris has occupied a part of my brain where thought usually takes place. It's like watching the antimatter version of yourself and you sort of cease to exist. Can I pitch it to you?
Yes, tell me.
Okay, so you know that Phil Collins's daughter is playing
daughter,
the main
Lily,
part,
yes. Yeah,
Lily,
yes.
Lily Collins, right? So imagine her in a beret.
Yeah, got her.
She's usually wearing some slightly misjudged outfit. Anyway, in the ones I've seen. So basically, she works for a company who I guess are in marketing or something like that, and she is tasked with the job of going over to a French fashion house to do their social media for them. Okay?
Yes.
I mean, it's this Darren Star writing this, of course, who, famously wrote, I think it goes back as far as Beverly Hills 90210, and then, of course, Sex in the City.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh, oh, yes.
Uh-huh. And then probably, well, hang on. Probably what was, 10 what was other things there? And then this.
What was that?
I'm just revering Sex in the City.
Oh, I see. I thought you were singing the theme tune to Juliet Bravo.
Sounded a bit like the theme tune to Dallas, actually, didn't it?
Oh, yes, it's Dallas. It was Dallas. You're quite right.
I don't know why I did that. I was just sort of bearing down.
There we go. Yes.
No, good. But anyway, he wrote those very successful shows. He's now written this show, Emily in Paris.
Yes.
And it's very hard not to watch it. Nothing about this show should work. It's very superficial. It relies entirely on cultural stereotypes. And basically, she goes over to France, goes over to Paris, and everyone's very French. And, you know, they have total disdain for her and her fashion. And, you know, that's all been done before.
Do you know what it is? Woody Allen would, you know, he was always in love with Barcelona and Paris and London, and he would set various films in these things, and they were just hilarious. You could tell they were written by an American, because much though he's, you know, he likes to get under the cultural skin of a city, he can't stop revering it for long enough to see it for what it is.
Yes.
And it's a sort of, it's an absolute myth.
Well, this Paris bears no relation to the Paris I've been to. But I have to say, you know, and maybe it's the confinement that's done it to me. But I've found myself looking quite longingly at the streets of Paris and thinking, maybe I could go and do the social media for a fashion house. And
well, you should do. Should do, though, Craig.
Drink frothy
coffees.
You'd
be phenomenal. None of your brown hats there.
I mean, it is quite extraordinary. One thing I will say about it is that he in some way manages to write heterosexual relationships like no one else I have ever come across. It's basically what he did in Sex in the City, which is it's an odd world to navigate, you know, and it's really hard to stop watching it because you kind of think, God, I wish life was this. God, I wish life ran on rails like this.
Simple.
I know where this scene is going because I know where the joke is going. That was telegraphed to me
about a minute ago.
And it's
telegraph to the same joke. Hasn't changed.
It's like
there we go. It's just a slightly bigger tassel.
Exactly. It's the same sort of pleasure you'd get out of watching all the trains on a Swiss railway. You know, there's no cultural edge. There's nothing being done that is in any way avant-garde. By God, that shit's running on time. Martin, how am I going to get up in the air with this contraption?
Well, I don't know. Do you want me to throw you up?
I tell you what, I'll hop on a pair of water skis, go behind your boat, you give it a good,
behind my
give
boat.
A good couple
hop
of
in,
knots. Hopefully the wind will catch
there we
me.
Go.
Here we go.
Oh, there we go.
Dahoy, Martin!
Off you go. Dahoy, Craig.
Up I go. There's no way this can work aerodynamically.
Up
it's
he
impossible.
Goes.
Bye-bye. Totally
up
impossible.
He goes.
Bye. Dahoy.
Time Ghost was written and created by Alexander Armstrong and Ben Miller. It was produced by Claire Broughton and Andy Goddard. This was a Hattrick podcast.